Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm Judge Jepal Harris. I appreciate your patience here. In a moment, we are going to begin calling cases. Just a couple of preliminary matters. First, this matter is being recorded. That recording will be released on our website after the argument. I tell you that to say, before you begin your argument, please state your name, and then you can begin your argument. Each party will have 15 minutes to argue, with the appellant having an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal. The podium, you can rise and lower it to suit your height, so please feel free to do so. I think there's a button on the left side. With that, Mr. Clerk, we can go ahead and call the case.
A24-0559, Joshua Ferry, appellant, versus Discount Tire Company of Minnesota, Incorporated, respondent.
And the appellant, you can begin when you are ready.
Good morning. My name is Katie Rollins. I represent the appellant Joshua Ferry. May it please the court, counsel. In short, the district court erred in granting respondent's motion to dismiss because in finding appellant lacked standing to pursue his claims, it failed to take appellant's allegations as true and drew inferences in respondent's favor. According to the Minnesota Human Rights Act, the opportunity to obtain employment without discrimination is a civil right. And as this court, or as the Supreme Court found in Kruger v. Zeman Construction Co., the act of discrimination itself constitutes a sufficient injury for the law to provide a remedy in the absence of statutory language requiring more. So, what is a discriminatory act under appellant's claims? Under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, it is considered discrimination for an employer because of a disability to refuse to hire or to maintain a system of employment which unreasonably excludes a person from seeking employment, or to discriminate against a person with respect to hiring.
Counsel, before we get into the merits
Sure.
of the discrimination claim, could we start with standing? Recognizing that to have standing, a party must have a sufficient stake in a justiciable controversy to seek relief from a court. The reference to justiciable controversy brings into play the concept of ripeness. So I think, you know, we don't even address standing until we determine whether the issue is ripe. So could you address, because I believe the district court said, you know, it's too soon, he hasn't applied, if he applies, he gets denied. Come back and see me. Could you address the ripeness argument or issue?
Yeah, I do think that there is some interrelatedness with when he has a claim under the MHRA in terms of ripeness. And that a little bit goes to the standing issue because obviously he needs to be able to plead some kind of discriminatory conduct that injures him. And that's what gives him the ability to bring a claim. That's what makes a claim ripe. Here, we agree, there was no formal application for a job. But requiring a formal application for a job glosses over a lot of the realities of the job search process.
Okay, let's talk about that, because I think you're going to futility, and I understand that. And so in Teamsters, the U.S. Supreme Court considered a lot of things. One argument they considered was, and I'm reading from the opinion, the thrust of the company's contention is that unless a minority group employee actually applied for a line driver job, either for initial hire or for transfer, he has suffered no injury from whatever discrimination might have been involved in the refusal of such jobs to those who actually applied to them. And the Supreme Court rejected that. And the Supreme Court said there's no per se rule, you have to apply in order to have a justiciable claim. However, in doing so, the Supreme Court said the effects of an injury suffered from discriminatory employment practices are not always confined to those who were expressly denied a requested employment opportunity, which is what you're saying. But the next line says, A consistently enforced discriminatory policy can surely deter job applications from those who are aware of it and are unwilling to subject themselves to the humiliation of explicit and certain rejection. And in the Teamsters case, the court reasoned that there was substantial evidence of a consistently enforced discriminatory policy which deterred job applicants. And that was based on statistics, the number of people applied. What is in your complaint showing that in this case there is a consistently enforced discriminatory policy that can surely deter job applicants?
I think that whether there's a consistently applied policy is a question of fact that's not properly resolved at the pleading stage. At this point,
Did you even allege a consistently enforced discriminatory policy?
I think in paragraphs 17, 26. I mean,
your complaint alleges he was told by two employees in response to his question that you won't get hired if you don't pass a drug test. How does that translate to an allegation that this business has a consistently enforced discriminatory policy that deters applicants?
I think the fact that there are multiple people that are reiterating this policy to appellant in his direct contact with the job. He is expressing interest in the job. He is asking about the possibility of being hired. And multiple times from multiple people, he is told, no, you can't get hired. Four times, two people. Twice when he spoke with the manager, Mr. Good, he spoke with Damien, who don't know his job title at this point, but then the inference is he spoke to his boss to inquire about what the policy is on hiring someone who's on the medical cannabis registry.
What I'm struggling with is this. Are we to equate these facts where somebody talked to a couple of employees and we're inferring that somebody talked to a boss, we don't know what that means, with what was described in the Teamsters case, which is, you know, a business having practices and procedures, you know, approved, implemented by the business? I mean, it seems that there's a wide range between what happened here and what was going on in the Teamsters case in terms of application of the futility doctrine.
I think that determining what that policy was and whether it was consistently applied is something that appellant is should get discovery on.
But then we have to ask, is it possible under any facts that, you know, discovery is going to reveal some proof of this?
Right.
And so you would say, well, the fact that these two people who work there said that, that's enough.
And there could be facts that are introduced in the record through discovery that show that there is, in fact, a policy
Understood.
That says.
Well, then let me ask one more thing, and then I won't take up more of your time unnecessarily. You know, I've gone through a lot of ripeness cases trying to figure out, is was this sort of, you need to apply from the job before it's ripe, an unreasonable hurdle. And you know, I find case after case that suggests it's not. I mean, in this one, Menard's constitutional claims are not ripe until after the market value of the subject property, as of the relevant valuation dates, has been determined, because that was a claim based on discrimination in terms of tax assessments. And then we had Thompson and Red Wing, where a landowner has not yet obtained a final decision regarding application of a land regulation to the particular property in question, the claim is not ripe. Again, another sort of discrimination context. A property owner cannot pursue inverse condemnation without first obtaining final determination of how the regulation affects the property. And I mean, it just, it goes on and on. And the idea is sort of, you know, take the step to apply for the job so then we know what happened and we can look at what happened and determine whether or not there's a claim here, as opposed to a hypothetical situation where your client is saying, well, based on what these two people told me, you know, I assumed that I wouldn't get hired, therefore I did not apply. So now let the court figure out whether there's discrimination and I'm entitled to relief. Well, how do we do that without kind of getting to the point of making the claim and having the record develop so we know what we're looking at?
I think the direct contact with the employer is important here. And that allegation kind of gets us over the line from just a hypothetical to concrete injury, being told he cannot be hired. I mean, really, it comes down to what is the discriminatory act that makes him injured? And, you know, the court at the district level looked at, okay, his seeking relief for lost wages and benefits is speculative because maybe he would not have been hired in the long term for whatever other reason. But the discriminatory conduct in telling him he cannot be hired because of his registry status is at minimum an emotional harm, which he is allowed to seek relief under the MHRA.
Counsel, what effect does just the context of the discussion? It's my understanding and my recollection that the employees didn't say you would not be hired, but rather that they thought he would not be hired, or they believed he would not be hired. And we have one individual, I believe Damien, who we do not know, and there's nothing in the record that tells us what his position is and what authority he has as it relates to hiring. What effect does that have on whether or not this matter is right?
So in paragraph 17, we do say that Mr. Good stated that defendant would not hire plaintiff due to his medical cannabis use. Paragraph 20, he says, yes, plaintiff could still be hired, but he would need to pass a drug test. But then I think that we get to the inference of discrimination in his subsequent conversation with Damien when appellant alleges that plaintiff could not be hired because he would not pass a drug test due to him possessing a medical cannabis card.
Well, that's sort of an odd assertion, because possessing a medical cannabis card doesn't mean you can't pass a drug test if you're not using, despite your possession of the card.
Right. It comes down to what the employer deems a pass. In other DATWA cases, we obviously don't have a DATWA claim here, but there are times when
I'm sorry to interrupt, counsel. Yep. So then the statement you just made, again, going to rightness, there's three separate statements. You have one saying you might not be hired, one saying you may be hired, but you have to pass a drug test, and then a third saying because you possess a cannabis card, you're not going to pass a drug test. Again, again, to your futility argument, when you have three separate statements which are contradictory, one saying you may be hired, one saying that you're going to get hired but you may fail a drug test, and one saying you're not going to get hired, why not apply at this point? Why not apply for the job, I guess, is what the question is.
I think it's a fair question, but ultimately whether it actually was futile for him to apply is a question of fact properly determined at summary judgment.
But at the ripeness stage, which is where we are, which determines whether or not the district court had a jurisdiction to even hear the case, I'm looking at Ford. And in that case, the court said, in this case, the evidence establishes that Ford's return to prison is imminent and almost inevitable, even if it has not yet occurred. So you're asking us to find that it was, you know, your client's denial of employment was imminent and almost inevitable based on three conflicting statements from people who were at, you know, at best a manager at the location as opposed to anybody at corporate who was working with HR to make hiring decisions.
We at this point don't know exactly who is making those formal hiring decisions. What he seeks recovery for is the harm of being told, no, you will not be hired. That is what he seeks recovery for. And the extent of that harm...
But is that harm... Does that harm constitute discrimination if there's no evidence that that was actually the position of the company?
I believe that it does.
How so?
Because we have to determine ultimately whether those individuals had some authority to make hiring decisions or influence hiring decisions. Again, that kind of comes to a question of fact, but the company is still liable for the statements of its agents.
Well, I just can't help looking at this pragmatically and thinking, you know, all of these unanswered questions and assumptions, I mean, that sort of goes to the essence of the ripeness doctrine. We don't want to be put in a position of deciding a legal issue when we don't actually know what happened or what would have happened, when it is instead very easy to say, well, we're going to wait until your property has had its tax assessed value, until the government has made you an offer on the reverse condemnation, until you've applied to the job so we know exactly what the outcome was. Because if he applied for the job and now the boss has talked to someone at HR and that person has said, hey, you can't deny him employment because he has a medical marijuana card, I think under Minnesota statutes, you could say you can't use marijuana during the day while you're at work. So you give the guy a job, and then if he uses marijuana at work, you fire him. I mean, I think that's a possible outcome. Why would we as a court embark on determining this hypothetical refusal to hire instead of just saying, well, for it to be ripe, we need you to apply for the job and see how it plays out. And if then, in fact, you come back to the court and say, yeah, I was discriminated against, the court will be in a position to resolve an actual existing dispute based on facts that have occurred instead of rendering an advisory opinion about a hypothetical situation. Isn't that the heart of justiciability and ripeness?
Yes, but I think that the Minnesota Human Rights Act creates broader liability outside of just a direct failure to hire based on someone who submitted a job application. That's where we're looking at that subdivision 2, where it says it's discrimination to unreasonably exclude someone seeking employment. And it doesn't define seeking employment, but there's no language in that subdivision that requires him to be a job applicant. It's much broader. It considers a much broader harm. So,
but justiciability goes to jurisdiction. If a claim isn't justiciable, a court might not have a jurisdiction. So even if we accept what you're saying is true, regardless of what the Minnesota Human Rights Act says, you still need to have a justiciable claim to get into court. It may be broader, but you still need to present the court with an actual controversy with some actual facts that show, yep, somebody has been injured, and we can resolve this controversy.
I think that to decide that this case is not ripe, you do have to ignore the statutory language about what an unfair employment practice is, because he gets here on statutory standing. That's what gets him his harm. He has to allege an injury under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. He does that by saying, you have unreasonably excluded me, a person seeking employment, because of my status on the registry. You made it futile for me to submit a formal application. And I think we can look at a hypothetical, and I just realized my time is out, so I will just finish my...
Go ahead, you can,
okay?
Go ahead, you can do so.
Someone goes into a Starbucks and asks for a paper application, and they're a woman, and the man behind the counter says, you know, no, we're not hiring right now. I'm not going to give you an application. He has taken away that person's opportunity to seek employment based on her membership in a protected class, presumably as a woman, and that should be covered in the harm.
Wait a second. In that example, they said we're not giving you an application because we're not hiring. How did we jump to he's discriminating?
Well, sorry, and maybe just we have to assume that they are, in fact, hiring, but we're not going to give you an application.
Go ahead.
One question, because it'll be relevant. We get to respond it. Is the theory of your MHRA claim that the status on the registry is a proxy for disability?
No.
Okay.
It really is that he has PTSD and so is on the registry for that.
Well, let me put it.
Yeah.
In other words, the disability is PTSD.
Correct.
Correct. And that by, I don't think PTSD was mentioned in the conversations, but is you're saying you sufficiently allege a claim of disability based on PTSD by virtue of saying I'm on the medical registry, right?
Correct.
Okay. And so another way we could look at this, I guess your argument might be, if he had said, I have PTSD, and they said, we don't hire someone with PTSD.
Correct.
And so you don't need to show practice. They just said it to him.
Yes.
Right? Is that sort of your theory?
Exactly. Okay. That would be direct evidence of discrimination. It would prevent any reasonable person from pursuing a job application with that person further. I think here it also is important that at least one of these people had apparent authority that he had some influence in the hiring decisions in his status as a manager.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Emily McNee, and I represent the respondent, Discount Tire Company of Minnesota, Inc., in this matter. Appellant Joshua Ferry is attempting a third bite at the apple here after two district court judges have dismissed his claims for a lack of standing and ripeness. His complaint should be dismissed, and the order of the district court should be affirmed because Mr. Ferry does not have standing to sue under the MHRA or the MCTRA, and his claims are not ripe because he never applied for a job at Discount Tire. His lawsuit now speculates about what might have happened hypothetically had he done so, but that's not sufficient to show a ripe controversy for the court to decide or to establish standing.
Do you agree with what I was just talking about, if a person calls and someone relays to them, even through a few calls, no matter what their status is, I checked with my boss or I'm telling you, if you have a disability, you need not apply. If you are a woman, you need not apply. If you're a person of color, you need not apply. That, you don't need to apply then, do you?
You know, the court talks about that in the Teamsters opinion as an example. If you have said, you know, no, we, you know, you don't need to apply because of XYZ protected class. And so the Supreme Court does give that as an example in talking about the futility doctrine under understanding. But that's not what's been alleged here in the complaint.
So isn't it sort of, though, by implication what's being alleged is I said I'm on the registry for medical cannabis. They took that to mean I have a disability, or that's what one, I could prove that that wasn't, you know, disclosed a disability. And that's just, you know, discrimination against me based on my disability.
I think that's
enough to just get past the really low threshold of a Rule 12.
I think that's a slippery slope to assume that anyone who's on the medical cannabis registry automatically has a medical condition that qualifies as a disability under Minnesota state law. Particularly when, you know, the complaint alleges a particular disability here, but doesn't allege that that disability was ever communicated to the employer, that any accommodation was ever sought from the employer, or that the employer knew of the disability or made any sort of assumptions.
So what if they had, if he had said, I'm on it on registry for purposes of my disabling condition of PTSD?
That might get you a little bit closer, but I don't think that the steps of futility are necessarily shown in that inference, particularly when we're talking about a drug test. When Minnesota has standards that apply for when an employer can conduct a drug test, we know that under DATWA it's only after a conditional offer of employment has been made. And there might be many steps in the hiring process before you get to that drug test where an employer might decide not to hire an applicant. And so it's really, you know, based on the hurdle that, you know, that drug test doesn't even come into play until later. There might be other completely legitimate reasons why an employer makes a hiring decision to reject somebody's employment. But when we look at the facts as pleaded in this complaint, we don't have evidence of allegations of a consistently enforced, entrenched policy of discrimination towards individuals, whether on the medical cannabis registry or with disabilities, that would cause an individual to feel as though it would be futile to apply. It's not the type of facts that would suggest that Mr. Ferry would be humiliated or embarrassed if he sought employment based on these conversations with, you know, certain individuals as alleged in the complaint. And so I don't think it gets you there under futility from a standing threshold, but it presents a different question under ripeness, where I don't believe we're looking at futility in the ripeness context. We're looking at, is there an actual case or controversy? And if you look, for example, at the Pacheco case cited in our brief, You know, you have to have benefits denied before claims are ripe. There's been
So in the earlier example I gave, if it's very straightforward, if you have a disability, you need not apply, and the person doesn't apply, you still say it fails ripeness, even though there might be a statutory standing?
There might be standing, but the claim might still be too speculative and hypothetical to be ripe.
What does the might mean? What do we look at to decide whether it is or not? If you call and say, I'm interested in the job, I'm a woman, and they say women need not apply, is that claim ripe without applying?
I think it depends on, you know, the particular facts that are in that complaint, but under your hypothetical, I think that might get us closer to being ripe and to having standing under Teamsters.
So both ripe and standing?
Potentially. That wasn't, you know, parsed out, I don't think, in that way by the Supreme Court in Teamsters, so I don't think we have binding authority that would control on that issue. And then separately under the MCTRA, there's no standing because there's no private right of action. At the time that, as the law existed at the time that Mr. Ferry's complaint was filed, the law doesn't provide for a private right of action for individuals to pursue claims under that law. I'll note for the court that in the 2024 legislative session that the MCTRA was repealed and then a new law has been enacted that does give a private right of action at Minnesota Statute 342.57, but that law isn't retroactive and doesn't apply here. You know, ultimately, when someone is, you know, believing that they'll be denied a job that they haven't applied to, a job that hasn't even been identified by, you know, position or location in the complaint, that's simply too speculative to establish common law standing, statutory standing, or ripeness for the court to decide, and not sufficient for the complaint to go forward. We've set forth in our brief some additional arguments for affirming the district court, namely that the Controlled Substance Act under federal law preempts the state law claims here, that the claims were collaterally estopped, or that they otherwise failed to state a claim on the merits. Those are more further set out in our brief, but I'll note, you know, that the MHRA, one of the requirements to bring a claim under that law is to have an adverse employment action. There's no adverse employment action until someone has been denied a position in this set of facts here. And so respondent requests that the complaint be dismissed and that this court affirm the ruling of the district court.
Thank you.
How does adverse employment action fit in if you have a facially broadcast, plainly discriminatory bar against certain employees based on a protected status?
Because there's no such allegation here that there's any sort of facial bar towards all applicants or any sort of consistent policy or approach.
Or even one that's told one off. I'm just getting to,
sure.
I think there's a little bit of an issue, I'll be frank, between the idea. I mean, I don't see a disclosure of a disability, for example, in the call. I mean, I know that you have, like, there's some questions around that, whether saying I'm on a registry is, you know, equivalent to asserting a disability. But I also think if a person calls and they get a directly discriminatory statement that we're not going to hire you because of your protected status, it seems that saying, well, there's no adverse employment action is because you didn't apply and get turned down, it really seems to gut the statute in the most, like, explicit of discriminatory practices.
And again, you know, the MHRA doesn't protect medical cannabis users. It protects based on disability,
right,
but not based on medical cannabis. And we simply don't have facts alleged in this complaint that would allow you to get to that question.
Well, counsel, I think I have the same question as Judge Smith. Let's set aside, it's clear that you're saying here there wasn't a disability disclosed. But in Judge Smith's example where someone calls and mm-hmm. says, I would like to apply, and they say, you're a woman, you're an African-American, you don't have to apply because we're not going to hire you. it seems to me that if you have statutory standing, it seems to me that that is also ripe. And you're saying maybe, or what are you saying? I'm just trying to understand.
Sure. So I think, you know, the Teamsters Court does give that as an example in talking about, you know, whether it would be futile for somebody to apply, and draws a line and says, yes, if you have that kind of an explicit statement that says, you know, females need not apply or whites only, for example, I think is one of the examples that the court gives. They say that would be sufficient to show that it's futile for you to go through the exercise of applying for that job to show the harm.
And you're just saying that's not the facts we have here.
Correct.
On the ground. Okay.
And so as I understand it, generally, I mean, could we read Teamsters to say generally you must apply for the job unless doing so would be futile, and it might be futile if there's a long-standing, you know, established pattern of discrimination, or if it's a whites-only sign.
Correct.
Which is just so direct and so explicit, there's no other conclusion to be drawn that it's discrimination.
That's right, Your Honor.
And here, we don't have anything that approaches that.
Correct. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think there's been a lot of talk about kind of what the facts are or what appellant will be able to prove, but I think it all comes back to what is the standard on a motion to dismiss. He only needs to allege a claim sufficient to give notice to the respondent of his claims. And in reviewing that pleading, the court has to take all of his allegations as true and make all reasonable inferences in his favor. And that is not what the court did here.
I need to press back on that. I agree that that's the standard for a Rule 12 dismissal, but if we're talking, you know, instead of did you adequately state a claim, if we're talking about does the court lack jurisdiction because you've not presented a justiciable claim, there is no actual controversy for us to decide, does that same standard apply in considering that latter issue of ripeness?
So I'm looking, and I believe it was in McLean. It was an Eighth Circuit case regarding fair housing, where they kind of address some of this utility doctrine. And one thing that the court notes is that the district court properly resolved fact issues in determining jurisdiction because the plaintiffs relied on materials outside the pleadings in arguing that motion. Here, appellant has not brought in anything outside of the pleadings, and so the court's job in this case was to take his allegations as true, and if there were questions of fact regarding his standing, they were to be resolved at summary judgment.
But even if we take everything in the complaint as true, and we're still left feeling like, you know what, there's no actual controversy here because he didn't apply for the job, he wasn't denied the job. So we don't have a situation where we're looking at somebody who was denied a job and these are the circumstances, there's a controversy. Instead, we have sort of a hypothetical. He didn't apply, but if he would have, he would have been denied, despite the fact that he might have been denied for reasons having nothing to do with medical marijuana use. I just don't see that taking all the facts in his favor helps him when we're looking at the issue of ripeness.
I respectfully disagree. I think the issue here is, did he face discriminatory conduct by respondent? Yes. He was told by two different people with at least apparent authority related to hiring that he would not be hired because of his status on the registry. That is really the harm, and the effects of that harm, the severity of that harm.
The complaint says you might not be hired. You won't be hired if you have a medical marijuana card. You won't be hired if you fail a job. I mean, it's not whites need not apply.
Sure. But I do think in the last paragraph of the fact section, when Damien confirms he could not be hired because he would not pass a drug test being on because he had a medical cannabis card.
But again, that statement is just silly, because just because you have a medical marijuana card doesn't mean you won't pass a drug test. They're two different things.
I think that is a legal argument, right, that you can, quote-unquote, pass a drug test under DATWA by saying, here's my medical marijuana card, this is why I tested positive.
Well, how about you have a medical marijuana card and you're simply not using marijuana, so you go to take a test and your UA is clean?
And I'm sure that there might be instances where that is the case, but that would require someone who is regularly medicating themselves with cannabis to stop taking their medically prescribed treatment in order to potentially get a job.
And isn't this the whole sort of hypothetical thing that I'm expressing concern with? Or this case could go a million different directions. We don't know, because he didn't do the simple thing that most reasonable people would do in the absence of the sort of futility evidence we see in Teamsters, which is an explicit sign saying we're not going to hire you, don't apply, or evidence based on statistics showing a long-standing ingrained pattern of discrimination that substitutes for that explicit sign.
I think the procedural posture at Teamsters is significantly different, because they had already found a discriminatory policy after trial. And they did a liability trial and then a remedial hearing to find individual futility for each individual plaintiff or class member. I think appellant, excuse me, here should have the opportunity to prove that there is a consistently applied policy.
Well,
at least
should the court's resources, because this is another aspect of the ripeness doctrine, should the court's resources be devoted to this issue, this claim, when there's not been an application and there's not been the sort of futility evidence that was described?
Yes.
Because it's like anybody could say, well, now, you know, tell your buddies, call Tires Plus, tell them you've got a marijuana card, you might be told they won't hire you. Now you'll have a discrimination claim as well.
If they're told that they won't hire them. I think that's really what it comes down to, is he was told he wouldn't be hired. And I think the legislature has expressed a willingness for judicial resources to be spent to prevent discrimination beyond just the formal job application process.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank both counsels. This matter has been submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory timeline. And with that, thank you. And the court will stand in recess.
All rise.